Guten Morgen, Düsseldorf. Als Ingenieur bin ich stolz auf die Worte, ich bin SRI und du kannst auch.
So, we gave a talk all over the world last year that touched on some of the problems to look out for in building an SRE program.
We got a lot of people who liked it and some people who approached us, you know, for some more prescriptive detail. But the fascinating people were the ones who would come up to us afterwards and say, well, that was great stuff, but we can't do this part of it because X.
And X was a lot of things, like we're a finance, medical, highly regulated something or other extraction industry company.
We're a classic enterprise with all this shrink-wrap software and a pure operations team.
We don't have enough staff to build all the stuff and handle all the pages.
Or, you know, my boss gets a kickback for every development job he outsources to some overseas contract shop and doesn't see any value in making improvements to our tech stack or workflow.
And honestly, we can't help you with that last one.
So we assume that if you're here at SREcon, unless you paid for your own ticket, like my friend Jonah, you have at least some level of buy-in from your executive management.
If your company doesn't realize that SRE is a company-wide strategy for executing on its mission and not just an ops team fad, you have to address that first. There's nothing that we can say today that can help you.
Right. That is another talk entirely. I'm sorry. Come see us give that next year at an ITIL conference near you.
That said, if you still have a knock, just referring to my talk last year, if you still have a knock, it's time to mothball it.
Let it go. I mean, you've mellowed, I guess. This time yesterday, you were still saying light it on fire. So at the very least, you need to have agreement at an executive level that reliability is a core feature of whatever service you provide and that your SLOs are company commitments, not IT commitments. Ideally, this should run all the way to the CEO, but at least it should go to the CTO, VP layer.
SLO is not a measure of how good your IT team is. They're a proxy for customer happiness and for what your company needs to do to win in the market.
Right. Business, product development, and all the people responsible for service delivery should all be in agreement on what they are and accountable for meeting them together.
If you don't have that, your measures will always be fungible. And the first time someone wants something bad enough, you'll have to compromise on your SLOs.
Or more likely, you'll end up being held accountable for delivering them in a one-sided fashion, right? And then asked to throw bodies into the machine to grease the gears.
The whole differentiator in SRE beyond a dedicated area, reliability is a dedicated area of focus, is establishing those feedback mechanisms that naturally converge on equilibrium rather than destabilizing without constant course correction.
So that said, we have, I know this is a lot up front, but we have one other caveat.
We're going to cover some strategies for dealing with things like shrink-wrapped software, non-transparent, contract-based, offshore development. But if you're dealing with those things, you're not going to get the full benefit of an SRE workflow.
Right. Long term, you need to have full software development lifecycle participation. Right. If you don't, you'll need to try and minimize that discrepancy and work to remove it in the long term. The goal here is to correct the situation, not make a lovely little legacy pearl that you never get rid of.
But wait, Jonah and Blake, how the hell do you know big internet guys know how to build out SRE from scratch? Like, didn't you just parachute into Netflix and Google when they already had an awesome SRE program?
Sure, but leaving aside our earlier careers, which I totally swear we had and we didn't just make them up to get jobs at big overpaid Silly Valley tech giants, the answer is still more than you probably think. Consider this. By moving to an SRE model, you aren't transforming your operations. You're transforming your entire company or organization. You split off a tiny part of the company, and then you gradually let it remake the entire organization in its own image.
You are, in fact, creating the company you want to be part of and then acquiring yourself.
Right. If you think about it this way, you automatically short-circuit a lot of the traps you can fall into when you need to change everything at once, or that you feel you need to fit into the existing governance structure, tooling, or operational boundaries. Nobody laughs, so I have to explain. I just realized how old this movie is, but Vint Cerf, it's funny because he's the same as the architect from The Matrix, and they're basically the same person or intellect or whatever. I mean, Vint, killer AI, Vint. Okay, great. You get the idea.
Okay, I think if you have to explain the joke.
Anyway. Hey, it worked this time, so
let's move on.
I stand by my methods.
Let's move on.
Okay, you may feel a bit daunted by the idea of introducing the SRE model and the cloud-native infrastructure to your existing enterprise offering.
You know, everyone knows that Google has this amazing next-generation architecture, but how do you get there from here?
What do all these people from Google or wherever know about the rocky road from pure ops teams running LAMP services to software engineers building and maintaining microservice, container, and serverless infrastructures that operate at greater reliability and velocity?
What might surprise you is how much legacy and non-standard infrastructure we have to deal with at any given time.
Yeah, acquisitions mean a continual supply of important services running on non-standard infrastructure, which is what Google calls the commodity hardware and public cloud resources that everyone else in the world calls standard infrastructure.
And it's not just acquisitions that bring up these issues.
No, in Google's case in particular, the company supports a large number of open source or other initiatives that also have to run in commodity hardware or public clouds or in edge POPs rather than Google's native architecture.
Open source, specialty hardware, and other systems are prevalent enough that you have to develop extensive tooling for managing, monitoring, and logging these systems with as much similarity as possible to your existing production infrastructure, even though those loads run under totally different conditions.
So SREs are critical to making all of this happen, you know, without creating service downtime and killing the goose for which we just paid all those golden eggs.
Sometimes it's not even an entire company or product that forces you to integrate a non-standard product that isn't designed to scale out and automate the way an SRE would really want it to.
Right. One time I was at a data center, and I was talking to the hardware operations folks there about some, you know, Chromium systems they were hosting for our testing or something like that. And they came across a really odd little, like a rack. It was a type of machine I'd never seen before, didn't know anything about. So I, you know, asked what it was and why it was there. In the middle of this giant data center the size of an airport, the manager like kind of looked both ways, you know, leaned in close, and he whispered,
"That's Eric Schmidt's BlackBerry server."
Okay, it was a lot louder than that because, you know, that's like, not how you whisper in a data center, actually. But anyway, it gets basically, they built systems to tie it into Google's monitoring infrastructure and logging, who knows what else. It was kind of amazing, but also crazy. And I just kind of said, huh. And then moved away really quickly because it seemed like an unnecessary career risk to be standing anywhere within camera view of the CEO's BlackBerry server for longer than I absolutely had to.
There's a lot of companies with SRE programs that aren't really interested in SRE. I mean, at one company I worked, all the SREs quit pretty quickly because it wasn't even clear why they were there.
I've had more than a few companies that look like great opportunities until I started digging into what they were actually wanting their new SRE department to accomplish. And I have friends who've landed in roles where they found inconsistent hiring bars, you know, no real commitment to defending SLOs, and a whole lot of other reliability theater.
Don't just hire SREs because they seem like something you might need, or because you heard that Google has them, or because you hired an engineer from Google and he said you needed them.
Unless that engineer was a Google SRE, and then please hire everyone they tell you to.
You need a real objective and a specific problem you're actually trying to solve. If you bring SREs on board and just sort of stick them in your existing ops team without empowering them to change or at least bypass your company approach to technology in general, they'll get frustrated and quit.
So whenever possible, grow SREs internally. Okay, hiring them is hard, and by hard I mean expensive.
SRE is not wizardry. It's not a prestige class. You don't have to have been in the industry forever and able to be able to do it. We've had solid success training new grads and early career software engineers to do this work.
Right, junior devs, new grads, even interns that grow into SREs are gold. Every time we say something like this, I find that somebody else is already in a talk on it, so we're just going to skip through.
Yeah. You have to have a solid culture and training cadre to make that approach work, where you seed this progress process with folks who've done this work before so that the right expectations can be set.
Don't just take an existing ops team and hand them a new set of titles and expectations.
It doesn't take a high percentage, but a few function heads, a few senior engineers can really help you from falling into some of those same organizational pitfalls and greatly accelerate the development of your culture and its teammates.
So that seems like a thing that's entirely reasonable to say if you're working in a Bay Area city or another place like Seattle or New York or London or Dublin, or, you know, where there are a lot of companies that already have, you know, established SRE programs to pilfer from. But what if you're based in, you know, Rathdrum, Ohio, and you can't afford to pry Dr. Kurt Anderson loose from LinkedIn?
I think he lives in Idaho, but anyway.
Ohio, didn't I? Terrible.
Because that's what the rest of the stock is about.
I can't read. I'm sorry. We're supposed to have notes. But so what exactly should our SREs be doing?
You know, when I was at Stripe, We saw SREs as developers that are primarily focused on tools lower down the stack. SREs can be a real force multiplier for other engineering teams. Instead of the traditional DevOps divide, SREs don't run ops. SREs build tools so everyone in the company can run ops.
So that's very important, right? Even at Google, the responsibility for a service ultimately resides with the owners, right? They can't walk away from that, even if they do have a relationship with outsources much or all of their production tool chain and operational burden to an SRE organization. At Dropbox, you know, on-call is a shared burden between SRE and product development. SREs build tools and infrastructure and automation, but they also help developers learn how to operationalize a service and work side by side with them in troubleshooting any problems that arise. Even so, you know, they never take ownership entirely. On-call isn't a primary or even a differentiating function.
Even teams that have SRE operations support, rather than consuming the platforms and tooling that operations that SRE provides, they should still serve as part of the on-call resource for their service.
Yeah, they handle ticket overflow, help fill occasional staffing shortfalls in the on-call rotations.
Nope. At a minimum, they need to maintain an on-call rotation of their own so that incident responders always have someone to contact when they get past their knowledge.
Sure. It's a partnership, not an abdication.
Reliability was really important to Stripe, and still is. As a company that handles hundreds of thousands of
it
other
really
companies...
was really important, they'd still have you working there. That
yeah,
would
maybe. As a company that hundreds of thousands of other companies, small and large, depend upon, reliability there is absolutely a feature, and they have firm buy-in on that across the entire company.
Yeah, I mean, I still can't actually quite wrap my head around some of the stories that you've told me about the early days there where they actually paged on every 500 that they, you know, generated.
Yeah. They're not quite that fanatical these days, but they still review all the 500s at a weekly meeting. Similar to how Netflix viewed SRE, most teams are responsible for running their own services, and I saw a lot of similar advantages and challenges at Stripe. One neat thing Stripe did was kind of, like, you know what sales engineers are? They used SRE as a sales engineering team for Foundation, which is the team that provide all the tools to run services at Stripe, like observability, operability, load testing, chaos engineering, and traffic.
So not the secluded repository created to safeguard advanced technology and scientific culture by Harry Seldon in the year 24,557?
No, why?
No reason.
So, at Stripe, the SRE team works directly with the product teams to raise the resiliency and reliability of every service. One of the tools we used to do this was literally called Carrot.
I love that name still.
It looked at all the production services, and it found areas where the service didn't implement best practices. We also started running production readiness reviews, but for every service, not just, like, is this new service ready to launch, like, remedially across every single service the company was running. Even if your service had been up since the company was founded, we started asking questions about capacity planning, failure testing, and other risk mitigation. We would have hands-on, like one-on-one sessions with teams to help them implement Foundation best practices. And we'd even, you know, gain a lot of trust by pair programming with them. Stripe also has, like, a huge culture of internal talks, office hours, and white papers.
Right. I mean, that last bit's actually really important, right? When people ask me what I'm looking for when I hire an SRE, and the thing that usually kind of surprises them is I say I'm looking for teachers.
SRE is an incredibly social discipline. That's why we all love coming here to hang out together.
Right, but we touch everything, you know, from the hardware layer right up through the infrastructure, you know, the delivery and communication with client software on the end user's system. Shared ownership aside, there will never be enough of us to accomplish all the things that we want to do.
Right, that's how we keep our salaries high.
The
only way
we
can succeed, really, is to teach others who are living at every one of those many levels what we know about running services in production, whether those are product devs or newly minted SREs, and then persuade them to implement the practices that we've learned to be effective.
Right. The only way we can succeed is to teach all of the people, you know, about that stuff. And SRE is really at its best when it's serving as a repository of deep expertise in scaling, distribution, and lessons learned about how production works under stress and how it degrades and fails.
And when it's focused on both building better tools and keeping that hard-won production knowledge fresh and well-distributed across your entire organization, regardless of whether the engagement level is at the individual service or at the broader platform level.
Right. There's some things that might not be for everyone.
Or, you know, everyone yet.
Like, you know, getting shared on-call responsibility.
Yeah, you know, ops at every org I've ever worked at is walking that burnout line, right? Either they're totally burned out or they're almost there. So when they hear dev is going to carry a pager, they're like, awesome! and they want to do that right away. But one way to build support for doing sharing the pager burden is to demonstrate the current level of effort that it takes to support the production services. My favorite visualization we did of this was a heat map showing the number of pages that were triggered by hour of day.
Okay, I mean, data is good, right? But I think we can all agree Etsy probably went too far when they started tracking the amount of sleep that all their ops team was getting with wearables. I mean,
yeah, maybe that'll just like scare people away.
Can't sleep. Servers might page me. So one way to approach this, especially if your intent isn't to share on-call long-term, is to make the on-call rotation short. Even if dev starts taking the pager one day a week, you'll see meaningful improvement in the attention paid to operational toil and load.
Right. At a company I was at years ago, the production engineering team, we were begging dev to implement this one feature to make it easier to perform maintenance. Eventually, we were just like, table flip, we're not supporting your service anymore, and we walked away from it. That feature was implemented within a week.
Okay, so good alignment technique, I guess. Once everyone's invested in running the service, you get an easier service to run. Okay.
Yeah. What about a centralized functional org?
Also a debate, right? At Google, all the SREs report to a different hierarchy than the project engineers, and in fact, they work on different teams entirely. This makes it easier for them to focus on keeping tech debt healthy, but it also can come at a cost to depth of knowledge on some of the systems we support or depth of relationship with our product development counterparts.
My friends at Facebook tell me that Facebook, the production engineering org, combines the advantages of a separate reporting chain with the value you get by deeply embedding with a product team.
Sure. And Dropbox, after going from a single central team, somewhat like the foundation group you were talking about, to actual like full embedding with no central organization, we're triangulating now back towards something halfway between Facebook and Google, where SREs are working in teams with separate reporting chain, but the individual SREs are focused deeply on particular services and serving as a lead for reliability for those endeavors in kind of the same way as an embedded engineer.
There's a lot of ways to accomplish this. The important thing seems to be that when people know that you can say no, you're much less likely to have to.
If everyone believes in error budgets, you might not even need a separate reporting chain. I mean, certainly companies like Spotify have tried this, right? You can still probably make reliability engineering work, although I really think, honestly, that the separate chain helps.
That said, SREs still need easy, scalable ways to work together with other SREs in the organization rather than just with their individual teams, and to have career options to grow into team leads and managers without having to abandon SRE for product engineering.
Sure. Centralized orgs can make that help make that happen, and thereby promote better sharing of lessons across product team boundaries, and reinduce the reinvention of the wheel. Right, less duplicative tooling can in turn mean better developed tools and less overall investment.
You need some way to make sure that production engineering efforts are valued just as highly as product development,
and are evaluated on appropriate criteria by people familiar with how various kinds of work can generate impact.
All this can be achieved without a separate dedicated SRE org, but it takes a lot more thought and individual dedication to keep those efforts on track in the absence of a formal organization that makes space for and reinforces those efforts.
Now, on the flip side, though, if you're dealing with a really sizable centralized organization, you'll start to find that the org cohesion gets difficult past a certain size. I mean, there's reasons most business units cap out at a few thousand employees, and like at Google, SRE itself is as big as an entire business unit.
So if we're going to treat ourselves like an acquisition, how are we going to SRE with teams outside our new SRE core?
Sure. So onboarding existing development and operations teams can be way more difficult than onboarding services. Historically, many of them were not accustomed to software engineering-driven development, test, production infrastructure practices, or not possessed of the skills they needed to execute on them.
And retaining or retraining staff or replacing attrition in such a major shift in a company structure and operations can be a daunting task.
Yeah. Fortunately, we've had some luck with some specific initiatives to cut down on the damage inflicted.
If you don't have a huge, well-funded organization, but you do have some skills differentiation and some gaps, read the Fine Manual Fridays are a pretty good way to handle it.
Right. This one's a little controversial because in general, I agree a blanket ban on Friday pushes and so forth is counter to the principles beyond, you know, that are behind continuous deployment. So just straight up read-only Fridays are kind of a less than ideal response to operational burdens.
If your infrastructure is causing you pain because you can't trust your CI/CD testing, canary production deployment practices to produce boring pushes...
I love boring.
We all like boring pushes, right? So the answer is not to like push less and have read-only Fridays. It's to fix your production deployment cycle so that you don't need to have read-only Fridays.
Sure. But the point, however, here is that that is not what read-define manual Fridays are about. And my machine is trying to add an update. Okay.
Here to do the
notes. Yeah.
Wow, we have gotten ourselves in quite a mess.
What have you got? What have you got us into this time? It's okay. We'll just lose a little time on every slide and make it up in volume.
Sorry about this.
Okay. Yeah, this is where we are. So we've emphasized, you know, ad hoc classes where folks with a computer science background will teach classes on, you know, software design. Here we go. Primary driver in this case. Yes, sorry.
So the primary driver in this case isn't production time. It's about carving time in your week to help staff help teach each other new skills and solidarity, emphasizing your commitment to the success of all your employees.
Right. The idea here is a temporary moratorium, say for several quarters, on making changes in production one day of the week.
And Friday seems to be a popular day for doing that.
I have no idea why, but yes. Instead, we use that time to do any number of staff improvement projects.
One of the most important aspects is we're not just talking about like giving your SREs books and telling them to study by themselves. It's not just individual study.
Right. We've emphasized ad hoc classes where folks with a computer science background will teach classes on, you know, software design or algorithms, and folks with extensive operational experience will conduct exercises in, you know, law and abstract large-scale design or, you know, Wheel of Misfortune-style troubleshooting exercises.
The important thing here is that everybody learns together, both teaching and spending time getting instructed by the peers on their team.
Right. Everybody gets to level up. Even if it's only by the kind of codification that you get, you know, when you have to actually explain something you thought you knew to a bunch of people with questions.
Everybody gets to see and share those things that their coworkers are actually kind of amazing at. And everybody pulls together towards the common goal of a higher functioning organization.
So this goes beyond the kind of team-specific things you get from having, you know, new folks, you know, continually working with experienced engineers to update your system and process and documentation.
That kind of learning is still really important, but this is more focused on when you have to grow more general skills in your entire staff that don't have the systems background that they need to succeed as SREs.
Right. So an outgrowth and extension of that, which can help in organizations that are too small for a dedicated education program, is a practice of shadow and pair coding.
Right. Folks who need to develop engineering, like software engineering muscles, can pair with people who already have them, and they're given sort of progressively more challenging projects to deliver.
Right. Ideally, these projects should, as soon as possible, be practical, focused on bugs or feature improvements in the services and tooling that those engineers actually use every day.
Like, by making sure folks had long-term relationships with engineering mentors and a pipeline of small to mid-sized but useful, like actually usable production coding processes, projects to work on, combined with the RTFM Fridays, we get a lot of sysadmins and test engineers that build their way into SREs and software engineers, production.
So the next step beyond that is where you have, you know, you're big enough, you have the resources where you can actually dedicate, you know, to this process as a permanent function for your organization. We originally had like about 5 slides of content on, you know, how to do this effectively, but then, you know, last night we saw that Jennifer Petoff is doing a whole talk on this subject. So I'm just going to say, go see Strapping Jetpacks on Unicorns, the Postmortem.
At 2 p.m. today?
2 p.m. today. And she'll tell you way more about the things you need to pay attention to with formal training than we could ever cram in here. So, hi, Jennifer. Stay awesome. Ein Bein brechen.
So it's fine to tell product developers that they're expected to run their services in production, but it can be really hard to implement that in practice.
Yeah. You end up with some teams that either due to the service or that they're working on, or maybe just because of the hiring mix, they're great and everything works well.
Other teams often don't really have that level of operational experiences to run services well if you just hand them a bunch of primitives. They need a lot more like handholding and training.
So, just last night I had someone ask me what the right mix of SRE to product engineers should be. And I had to say, it's a very individual calculation, right? Certainly Google has the published heuristic of about 1 in 10 engineers being focused on reliability. But you have to ask yourself this, is your organization as efficient as Google's, right? Is the operational burden, the toil, the friction of running a service as low as it would be at Google?
For most places, probably not.
Right. So if you wanted to run your services in the same way Google does, with SRE shouldering the same percentage of the operational burden, you're going to need 1 in 8 or even 1 in 5 engineers to be doing SRE.
Right. But that's not the only solution. Another answer is to share the operational burden through a larger percentage of your organization.
Yep.
So it's not just SRE taking it on. Then you can use the resources that buys you an SRE to continually increase the organizational efficiency of your systems and processes to the point where you can be more like Google.
So the key thing is to come up with a good mechanism for limiting the engagements that SRE is responsible for to something that is scaled appropriately to the size of the organization you're able to attract and retain. And this is where I talk for a really long time. So at Dropbox, we have an ongoing SOA initiative where we're decomposing some existing monolithic service components into a distributed architecture. And the carrot, for the developers running services is pretty standard, right? More autonomy, not being tied to the daily push cycle, better control and observability for their service. But for us, it's an opportunity to establish direct and ongoing SRE relationships with teams that have never done infrastructure work before and need a little more assistance than those who have, right? So we get to use this onboarding process as a choke point to make sure that, we don't take on more burden than we can sustain with the staff that we're able to provide. And Dropbox gets to get a safer, cleaner, and ultimately a faster transition than it would, probably achieve if we just handed the product teams a bunch of documentation and told them to make it happen.
So we talked earlier about how there's no substitute for executive buy-in, but executive buy-in gets you nothing if you use it like a stick. Use the commitment you have to give you some space and resources to build some carrots.
Yeah, it may seem like, acquisitions have the forcing function of ownership to drive the cultural and business structure towards adopting an SRE model for executing their mission. But the truth is, at least at Google, it's still as much of a carrot approach as anything. Unless they're very small, companies aren't forced off their existing architecture, and they can even continue to fund its expansion.
Right, the efficiencies of moving to GCP and Borg and the attractiveness of building a working relationship with the SRE organization are readily apparent, even to companies that have significant legacy infrastructure to move over.
So this attractive force is why it's important to focus your initial efforts on building something that's better and more efficient than the existing systems and processes, and then offer that to teams for adoption rather than diving into their existing processes and infrastructure and trying to fix them off the bat.
I can't emphasize enough that you need executive backing for your engagement model and executive buy-in to your purpose and its deliverables.
Right. What the company hopes to get out of SRE and how SRE is expected to engage to provide it. If those guidelines aren't in line with SRE best practice and they aren't blessed by the leadership that's relevant, then you won't be able to create the breathing space and enforce the norms needed to successfully migrate to an SRE business model.
Right. SRE is about the execution strategy of the entire company. It's not just about your SRE teams.
Prioritization, staffing, the definition of success, and flow from everything just comes from this business level establishment of the metrics that are important to the company and how SRE will impact them.
So when it comes to spreading SRE to the business as a whole,
carrot beats stick.
Every time.
Right. Although sometimes you need to build a carrot that's big enough to hit people over the head with.
You can beat engineers into submission, but if people resent what you're doing, they're going to do a poor job of it, or they'll quit and go work somewhere like Dropbox.
We are hiring. But if instead the engineers see that they get to use all these cool tools, and if they do it your way, then hey, they'll generally hop on board.
Engineers do love shiny objects.
Everybody loves shiny objects. Who doesn't? But so we've all talked, you know, about focusing on tooling, building your teams with a core group, you know, implementing these new improved pipelines and platforms, and it sort of gets metastasized into the rest of the organization and supplants the old struggling systems and cross-trains other teams with newer, more efficient approaches.
But, like, what kind of technical approaches work best, and how can you get the most traction and the fastest? How specifically do you link your existing systems into the new tooling to get the maximum adoption and effect?
What are the shiniest objects?
Actually, like, scratch shiny objects.
Okay, fine. So that's fair. Shiny objects are fun, but let's talk about the grungiest ones instead.
How do you deal with the systems that cannot be brought into your homogeneous cloud-based infrastructure, or systems that are painful to build into your new standard infrastructure, like
edge cluster and microcluster systems,
hardware testing and hardware-linked software appliances,
open source repositories that can't be combined with your internal ones,
test and integration systems that need to allow non-employee access,
end-of-life proprietary black box components where nobody knows how they work and everyone is scared to touch them because they might fall over.
Or what we call shrink wrap software.
Okay, fine. So possibly the best solution, this is going to sound like a cop-out, but we'll get to other stuff later. Find a service provider to run it for you as a service where possible.
Right. Let somebody else do the undifferentiated heavy lifting. But be careful, though. If it's in critical path, you really need to trust that vendor.
Right. SLIs, SLOs, SLAs that, you know, you can believe in.
Right. Shared telemetry.
Shared response. If, you know, if your pager goes off, theirs should, too.
Right. They should care about your reliability, not just their reliability.
Right. If you can't get that, right, if they aren't going to see that the 5% error rate that they have is 90% error rate for you, then, you know, you may actually be better off running it yourself as a black box or an SDK.
Right. Wrap it as much proxying, oh, I love proxying, and instrumentation as possible to bring that observability data back into your existing systems.
So in this situation, right, the system probably won't support scale-out methods, so you'll have to build a lot of protections in the parts of your own system that need to call on it, right? So the idea is that, you know, you handle the load shedding, graceful degradation, timeouts, and so forth that the system itself can't, and add, you know, external caching and sharding where you can, that sort of thing.
This is much harder and less effective than running a system that is capable of being improved upon directly.
But it can be done.
Like with a BlackBerry server.
Just leave Eric alone.
I'm sure he's on Android by now.
Okay, so that's a daunting list. So where do we start?
I mean, there's so much to SRE. How do we get from, hey, this was a fun book to read over the course of a weekend, long weekend, to, I see this is making a difference now.
You have a much less interrupted life than I do if you read it in a weekend. I initially, you want to focus on building developer, test, and production infrastructure that can efficiently support the new model. If you already have that, great, you're halfway to win.
Right, but if you don't, focus on the construction of a good CI/CD pipeline so that you can use that to deploy and monitor production jobs that are written in this new paradigm.
Right, again, you're building a little company inside your company. Design based on the world you want to end up in first, not what you can do to evolve legacy directly.
Don't boil the ocean. Build, and then build on, small and discrete wins. Do not try to introduce SRE practices or new tooling in every place at the same time.
Right. Pick specific tools and processes that will be useful to a broad section of users, and then improve them in ways that will drive organic adoption.
Right. Build solid primitives, then build workflows with easy-to-consume UX out of those primitives so you can move from doing integrations to actually doing real innovation.
So you're not going to try to migrate all the old stuff, right? You're just going to make a place where new tools and services can live and then work on making that communicate with the old world.
Look for ways to push that system as far out as possible into your infrastructure as a single homogeneous tool chain before you have to start, like, breaking it for those last few pieces to get that last legacy systems integrated.
Right. So, I'm going to apologize a little bit because we're running late for time, so I'm going to cut some of this a little shorter than I would otherwise. But, you know, we were designing a new standardized approach for handling, you know, non-standard infrastructure. And one of the things we had to come up with was a method for doing builds and pushes for new platforms that were different from the environment in which all our native software and so forth ran. So this is a real grab bag of stuff, like test labs, acquisition services running VMs in Kubernetes on GCE, edge servers located in POPs, mini clusters running Linux and other OS distros in data center ghettos, all their kinds of strangeness. So rather than build separate repository build test, production tool chains for each environment, we elected a design where we build out scaffolding from the existing code repository and build clusters, to kind of take those build products, update them to the non-standard environments outside, and deploy them in an automated fashion, right? This let us use the same code review and continual testing and deployment tools to reach all our platforms and deploy in an automated fashion. It reduced the overall number of times that we had to rewrite different parts of that pipeline and the overall cognitive load of using the system and maintaining it, right? It even also sets us up for using our existing monitoring and logging for all of that portion, so we only have to work out non-standard ways to handle that final mile.
Bring monitoring and production controls back to that new shared environment for all teams.
Yeah, you can get significant consistency and observability gains by converting, just flat out converting your legacy monolith or whatever to run in an immutable container.
Right, like you don't need to jump into microservices right away, right? That decision should be really decided based on how independently you need your systems to scale and how independently you need your systems engineering teams to work together. Not any mythical availability expectations or just because Netflix is doing it and it sounds cool.
Right. The goal here is to get easy access to the build, push, and observability chains that you're building for your brave new world, not to re-architect all your legacy stack out of the gate.
Once you've got that, implement wrappers and proxy interfaces to insert instrumentation and provide standardized structured logs.
Yeah. I mean, if I could leave people with only one technical strategy or takeaway, it would be this. Build proxies for your problems.
Right. I got 99 problems, and file storage is all of them.
Okay.
Proxies allow existing systems to consume new services that were written for microservices, containers, and modern observability without expensive rewrites, or by simply pointing their output at the new proxy and letting the proxy scrape the data remotely or running a local agent to handle the mechanics of getting the data out to the proxy.
So there's a little overhead, right? And you lose the ability to do some kinds of custom error handling and process internal instrumentation compared to doing it all natively.
But these sort of solutions make the new work you're doing immediately available to the parts of the company that couldn't benefit otherwise and increase your impact and the willingness of teams to work with your new platform and your CEO to keep funding the effort.
So, I mean, at one point, I inherited a bunch of messy, unstructured logs that were painful to try and parse for relevant information, right? And rather than digging into the systems that were generating them line by line, we built a logs proxy to take the unstructured logs and apply protobufs and a bunch of pattern matching to create structured logs and ingest them into our central log service, right? We got a number of solid, usable fields right out of the gate, and another one that was basically a dumping ground for like a decade of corner case log information that it was intended to be readable by humans rather than machines, but in practice actually ended up being kind of useless to both. But the point is that that part we could chip away at our leisure through parsing and also slowly improving the rigor and the product code that produced logs in the first place. But we got a great 80% win up front and some breathing space to continue to make things better over the long haul rather than having to go out and convince a lot of teams to make changes up front. We took a similar tack with, getting legacy systems into our monitoring, right? Proxies extend the black box monitoring into, networks where we wouldn't be able to access them from the cloud infrastructure. Other proxies, and client agents, would sit on the systems and scrape the, legacy SNMP or whatever other monitoring data and ingest it into VAR-Z and Stream-Z time series, systems for the kind that Prometheus was originally based off of. So these run in parallel with our legacy monitoring, which means no awkward transition period between systems. Legacy jobs are visible in legacy and replacement consoles. And then as new jobs are spun up, they show up in that same new replacement console as everything else, making it easy for everyone to adopt the new tooling. And I'm not done yet, sorry. It wasn't just the strategy for mid-size acquisitions either, right? During my time at YouTube, they made extensive use of proxies to carry traffic between legacy YouTube data centers and, you know, the new Borg components that were being used to replace parts of the system. I mean, one other thing, make sure that you have a workable mechanism to keep quota and configuration on these proxy systems in sync with the settings on the systems that they service, because there is nothing sadder, other than Jonah waiting for me to stop talking, than being paged at like oh crud 100 on Christmas, because the capacity planning that you did, you know, to ensure availability on all the actual services means that now you've exceeded your Spork proxy quota and you're piling up traffic like sad, melty little snowflakes. How about very large relational databases?
Yeah.
So again, YouTube was a heavy user of MySQL at the time, right? Large relational databases can be a challenge to create, to migrate. So they created this thing called Vitess. Again, we're trying to save up some time from the late start. So it's a project they open sourced to create sharding and gRPC connection, you know, layer, sort of a proxy to enable horizontal scaling of MySQL, you know, without requiring custom sharding code in every application that needs to consume MySQL resources. So, again, it's open source. You can read about it online. I won't do the details. But we have something similar. It's a common pattern, right? Facebook has Tau. At Dropbox, we actually imported one of the original creators of Vitess. So, oddly enough, we ended up with a similar system called Edge Store. It's actually likely to hit 12,000 servers in the next year. But it works, right now we're using, the runway we get from implementing that to, migrate to new systems that aren't based on MySQL and can provide the same functionality, without the overhead that we need to maintain the old ones. So, we get the improved scale, and, Edge Store isn't open source, but it is, on our blogs and so forth. You can read about what makes that different.
So, one of my favorite open source tools out there...
I'm going to let you finish, but... Envoy is possibly one of the best open source tools of all time.
Well, it is Envoy. it is probably the most comprehensive example of a proxy that can take an existing system without a lot of the modern capabilities that we've come to rely upon in SRE and rapidly improve the survivability and operability of a system.
Sure. By running Envoy in parallel with your existing jobs, to abstract out your network and RPC layers, you can use it to assist with scaling out, adding observability, and making it easier to break out pieces of your existing monolith or service mesh for replacement, right? If you can run Docker images, you can use this. And if you can't, you can build it natively and run it that way, too, to get started.
Proxies enable agility as well. One thing we've done to implement SRE in a financial services company like Stripe, people are like, you can't run in financial services. We run financial services. Heavily regulated, hundreds of billions of dollars, or billions of dollars, is that we moved all that heavily regulated information into a proxy layer that tokenized all the data so that the engineers working in the rest of the company didn't have to worry about PCI compliance. That was being managed by this one little team and this one little proxy layer, and it was awesome.
Minimize the number of sad engineers.
Right.
So this is actually a great topic, right? The thing about regulators is that they really like regulation, right?
Yeah, it's possible to implement SRE in a heavily regulated environment.
Regulators actually generally go wild for the kinds of predictability, transparency, and explicit deliberate risk modeling that SRE implements.
And by wild, if you've ever actually met one of the auditors, is like, I think we have all the information we require.
These controls seems quite sufficient.
Yeah, I don't see anything here that seems out of order.
Okay, so what do regulators love about SRE and why?
Oh, they love containers because you get immutable, hermetic, build and deploy artifacts that are really easy to audit.
Right. Continuous integration and deployment, because a consistent and reliable deployment process that includes testing and verification reduces risk and makes it possible to determine that, what you delivered to production is the same as what you built.
Right. And observability. What's not to love about having a comprehensive record about the status of your systems, the data they touch, and their overall health?
So, error budgets and risk calculations.
Quantifiable risk is like candy to regulators. They don't want you to tell them that you don't have any problems.
No, that just makes them wonder what you're hiding, and or maybe not thinking of, and then they start digging around.
What they want you to do is show that you've figured out what your biggest problems, your biggest risks are, and that you have mitigation plans in place.
Yeah, a great way to do this is with a quantified risk matrix like expected cost, which is something you want to do anyway for your own planning on, you know, what risks to prioritize addressing in your roadmap for the year.
The important word here is quantified. You want to attach the actual minutes of downtime to the projections that you create, not just categorizations like high, medium, ultra, low.
What is even that? Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, you want to build those projections based on actual duration and frequency of outages historically.
Or in the case of things that haven't yet happened yet, the likely amount of downtime that you're going to incur from that sort of failure, sort of a best guess of how often you're going to lose three regions at the same time.
How many pelicans are going to fly into a power line in like the next 10 years? Yeah, okay. So I like to annualize everything because it yields a pretty reasonable smoothing of the data, and it also lets you focus your mitigations, you know, on, and your regulators for that matter, on projects that will actually most benefit your organization. Matt Brown from Google CRE actually gave a great talk on this at SREcon Americas earlier. I live tweeted it at the time, but I really encourage you to go check it out. That said, external regulators aren't the only place where proxying and a containment strategy applies.
Who here has or has in the past had to get everything past an external change control board? Yeah, fun, right?
Yeah, okay. So, you know, or maybe say your broader organization is using a cumbersome, you know, waterfall planning cycle that locks in decisions and budget minutiae for like a long time in advance. Maybe you have congressional oversight. I mean, you know.
Yeah, one of the best things you can do to ensure your success is to get a carve out for your SRE initiative, where within a broad area of domain and delegation of authority, you're able to work with a lightweight peer review based process rather than playing mother may I with some crazy governance structure.
Honestly, research shows that all technological choices, like all these things we're talking about, proxying and risk, all this stuff, it doesn't matter nearly as much as basic things, like being able to make and adjust decisions rapidly.
Right. We know that change review boards actually have no positive impact on uptime and effectiveness. It doesn't matter if you have all the shiny things like Kubernetes and Prometheus, or if you're doing microservices or any of these other hot topics.
What matters is if you can test and ship code rapidly and get real-time feedback on whether it's working and adjust immediately when you don't hit the targets that you want.
Resilience trumps robustness.
You just can't say Trump. Every time.
It messes me up. Real-time review by peers with high context provides the value that an external review can't and can satisfy regulatory requirements while still preserving velocity.
Yeah, if you're having trouble selling your management on this fact, then probably the best thing you can do is to get them to read Accelerate by Jez Humble, Gene Kim, and Nicole Forsgren. Getting actual causal linkage between effective service development and delivery and a particular, you know, organizational capabilities is one of the most exciting things that I've seen in like the last 5 years. So if you can't do that, read it yourself and give them the Cliff's Notes.
And Nicole released the latest State of DevOps report like 2 days ago, so perfect timing. One last thing, one last trick. Make things better with ratchets. So we were really strict about code quality at Stripe, and we had all these linting rules and all these tests that looked for things that didn't follow best practices, but we would only apply it to new code or any code where the lines of code were being touched in a check-in so that you wouldn't like introduce a new linting rule and then somebody had to go fix 400 new issues that appeared in all different parts of the code base before they could ship their microservice.
Yoink, you just thought that code worked, right?
Right, yeah, exactly.
So, all right, wake up time. If you've been doing something else for the last 40 minutes, I mean, hey, it's day 3. We understand. The good news is you can now pay attention for 2 minutes and catch like 90% of our talk.
So you can totally do this.
Not just pay attention for 2 minutes, although I'm sure you can do that too. We mean you can actually take your organization from SRE curious to SRE capable in just a few years.
I mean, if we can do this, anybody can.
This much is certain. We have people come ask us what it takes to be an SRE, and we tell them, you know, if you're working in a DevOps paradigm, you already have the technical skill set to be an SRE. If you don't, you can build it.
We're no different as individuals.
What is different from a classic ops or even a DevOps paradigm is the clear focus on overall reliability and the healthy homeostatic feedback systems we've built for balancing the allocation of engineering resources more effectively and with reduced conflict.
Build trust.
Right. Deliver stuff people can count on, and then deliver more.
Do not try to change everything at once.
SRE is part of a company-wide DevOps program.
The end goal is not for just SRE to be the only group working in that paradigm.
Right. Spread the love.
You're here to enable others to reach the promised land.
Get backing from executive management.
If you don't already know how to do that, come see the talk we give next year when enough people ask us how to do it.
If you do know how to do that, come see me after, because I'm always looking for new methods of organizational manipulation.
Focus early efforts on building improved tools and platforms in parallel to your existing systems.
Carrots, not sticks. Really big carrots.
Use proxies, I love proxies, and extenders to make these new tools as useful and available to as many consumers as possible with as little effort and duplication as possible.
Build your team and your skills, and then, you know, build a path forward for other teams to join you.
Don't let despair or false expectation of disposability or a career dead end spread to the and consume the operations teams that you rely upon for your current systems.
This is very important, try not to forget to do any of the important stuff that we forgot to tell you today.
Right. The stuff we did tell you, like, hey, no biggie, it's written down.
Also, we don't know everything.
If you figure something new out, tell us.
Vielen Dank, meine Damen und Herren. You are now free to move about the conference. And I apologize slightly. We tried to do 54 minutes of content in 45 minutes. So if you do have questions, you want to talk to us after, you know, out in the hall, we are happy to give more detail on things.